Across time, different languages have been the international standard, known as the lingua franca. During the Roman Empire, Koine Greek and Latin became the standard. In the 16th and 17th centuries, Spanish became the language of diplomacy, followed by French, until English took over. This makes us English speakers quite happy, but in our first piece, Ben Savage, David Heyman, and Nate Solon look at why English might not be the best language for the job, and maybe a made-up language from Poland called Esperanto is.
A few months ago, I was standing in line at a McDonald's in Beijing. McDonald's in Beijing looks pretty much the same as McDonald's in America, except most of the people are Chinese and, well, the menu's not in English. I can't read Chinese, so all I had to go on were pictures of burgers and McNuggets, so I began to order very hesitantly. One number four, a Diet Coke, and an apple pie. The cashier asked me with choppy English if I cared to supersize. Sure, I said, supersize me. As I waited for my food, I had a few minutes to reflect on how convenient it was that my language and my Big Mac had followed me to Beijing. I felt secure in the sense that I could travel to any corner of the world without giving up my God-given right to supersize. But then my food came. Four cheeseburgers, four fries, and four Cokes. All supersized. Maybe I should have complained. But I wouldn't have known what to say. I was going to need a lot of ketchup. The problems with English as an international language go far beyond fast food mix-ups. English is one of the toughest languages in the world for non-native speakers to crack. It's filled with strange rules and exceptions that can remain hard to grasp even after years of study. If we were to choose an international language just based on its own merits, English would be close to last in the running. But since the world's superpower speaks English, it's become the de facto language of choice. As a student at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, I have the opportunity to interact with students from all over the world. I interviewed some of my foreign friends about their experiences learning English. My friend Lisa grew up in Sweden and found learning English no small feat.
It was really hard to learn English. One could say it was very tough to learn English just with that word, tough. Like, where did that F sound come from? If you look at the spelling. The spelling is definitely really hard, and coming from a Scandinavian language where you pronounce everything that you read, it was very hard to get over.
I had seen posters around campus advertising meetings for an Esperanto club. Esperanto, the international language, they said. I was more than ready to check out alternatives to English, but not quite ready to venture into a meeting for a group that I knew nothing about. I googled Esperanto and came up with, among other things, a movie, Incubus. Incubus is the only full-length feature ever made entirely in Esperanto. It seemed like a nice, easy way to find out what this language was all about, so I went ahead and rented it. It's kind of a strange movie. Incubus stars William Shatner as a virtuous man who is seduced by a sex-crazed demon.
Midizilus kenu estu kuni, sed gravus tre malmultis iniae animoi ne estes unuigitai.
That's Shatner at a particularly wrought moment. The subtitle reads, "I want your body, and I want to give you mine, but bodies mean very little unless we also give our souls to love." Needless to say, Incubus wasn't the best movie I've ever seen. I was about to dismiss this Esperanto, but something seemed fishy. If all there was to this language was just this corny ranting of a young Captain Kirk, then why would anyone promote it as an international language? The next time I was at the library, I dug out a couple of books on Esperanto and found out the real story.
Ah!
Here's what I learned. Esperanto derives from a book published in 1887 by Ludwig Zamenhof. As a boy, Zamenhof witnessed ethnic struggles between Poles, Russians, and Jews in his native town of Bialystok, then a part of the Russian Empire. He thought that if the different groups could at least understand one another, they might all get along a little better. Zamenhof, an avid linguist, concocted Esperanto using his knowledge of Russian, Yiddish, Polish, German, Latin, English, and other languages. He designed it to be simple and easy to learn. Now that sounded a lot more like an international language. I did a little more research on Incubus, and found out it wasn't even made by Esperantists. In fact, much of the pronunciation, including Shatner's, was incorrect. As a first impression of Esperanto, Incubus could hardly be more misleading. Confident now that I wasn't entering the midst of a bunch of demon-worshipping crackpots, I ventured into the weekly meeting of the Stanford Esperanto Society in a little room at Stanford's International Center. My first sight of the Esperanto Society brought back some of my fears. The members of the society could be visitors to a Star Trek convention. One man, with a ponytail, was licking the pulp from the cap of his Adwala juice drink. An older woman wore a red velour jacket, and under it, a t-shirt that said in big letters, "Keep Santa Cruz Weird." Her name was Julie. She was the president of the San Francisco Esperanto Regional Organization. I asked her what attracted her to Esperanto, and got a surprisingly reasonable answer.
Well, I was visiting a relative in Florida and happened to read their copy of the Wall Street Journal, which I don't normally read, and there on the front page in April of 1994 was an article about Esperanto, which I had heard about just as a word but really had no idea what it was all about. And I really liked what I read, the purpose being to have an international second language that would be neutral, that everybody could easily learn and then use wherever they went in the world. And I thought, wow, that is so nifty.
A nifty idea, sure. But is it practical? Julie explained how Esperanto actually makes economic sense for international organizations like the European Union.
Because as it stands, they have a huge budget just for translating materials from one of the 15 or 20 different native languages into all of the others. And if it was possible to go from, say, Greek to Esperanto and then from Esperanto to Polish, then you wouldn't have to have somebody who could speak both Polish and Greek easily.
That did make sense. But was Esperanto really as easy as everyone said it was? I asked Julie to tell me more of the details. Remember how Lisa mentioned tough? In Esperanto, the word is malfacilia, spelled phonetically, like every other word in the language. That's not all she told me.
All the nouns end with O. So if you hear a word that ends with O, you know it's a noun. All the adjectives end with A. All the plurals end with a letter which looks like a J, but which is pronounced like a Y. So, for example, tablo, table, tabloi, tables. Granda tablo, big table. Grandi tabloi, big tables.
On my way out the door, I asked Julie if she'd seen Incubus.
I have not ever seen the whole of it. I have seen parts of it, and it was an interesting experiment, I would say. I wouldn't call it a great film.
Julie made a strong case for Esperanto. But B. Sanford, a Stanford student studying language, warned me against embracing a language that didn't have a rich cultural background behind it.
I mean, as a linguist, I feel that language is very important to representing a culture, and I think the idea of having a language, you know, where people of different cultures would all have to learn it, maybe it works as a way of cross-cultural communication, but I don't think that would really be very representative of any specific culture, and so because of that, I feel that Esperanto minimizes, you know, cultural diversity.
I decided to see what the Esperantists had to say about that. Julie sent me to Joel Brzozowski, the director of the Esperanto League of North America. So I drove over to the league's headquarters in Berkeley, California. At first, I wasn't impressed. His office was just a corner of a little building in a rundown part of town. But I found Joel to be a truly sincere and informed guy. Joel has traveled widely in Europe, using both English and Esperanto. He says he found Esperanto much better for accessing cultural diversity than English. With English, something was missing from his travels.
When I finished, I felt a very definite lack. And that lack was human contact. I met very few people who actually lived in the places I was visiting. Met in the sense of really being able to sit down and talk with them and make friends with them and understand how they're thinking. And so that's what convinced me to go traveling again and do it differently.
Because English is so hard to learn, most non-native speakers don't feel comfortable using it. They're less likely to express their personal thoughts because they're afraid they'll say them wrong. The very fact that they have to speak English in their own country is already evidence that they're in a culturally disadvantaged position. In fact, English is really good for one thing.
When I travel with English, I find that most of the people that speak to me in English are not interested in me or in my culture or really in making friends with me. Most of them are interested in money.
But Esperanto, as a universal second language, puts everyone on an even footing.
With Esperanto, it's quite seldom that you run into people who speak to you in Esperanto whose primary purpose is making money. And most of the time, they're interested in making friends. And it's definitely a different feeling and a different result.
Not only does Esperanto give travelers a better shot at appreciating native cultures, Esperantists, Joel says, have built their own culture. A culture based on warmth, openness, and friendship.
A great many of them are genuinely interested in other cultures and people of other cultures and in making friends. So, in general, if you run into someone who speaks Esperanto, there's a very good chance that that person will be very friendly and want to be your friend.
It sounded like Esperanto worked great for Joel, but the Esperanto Society posters called it the international language. I wasn't sure it was really that. While I was in Joel's office, Don Harrow, author of the Esperanto book and consultant for the Esperanto League of North America, happened to drop by. I asked him how Esperanto fulfills the ideals of communication and understanding that the phrase international language brings to mind.
What it can serve to do is give individuals peaceful relationships with individuals in other countries, which is fairly important. When you decides to go to war with another country, the first thing you have to do is demonize the people who live there. Basically, an individual who knows somebody in the place in question is less likely to see those people as demons. Just because somebody in Washington wants to go to war with them, for whatever reason.
He went on to give me a personal example.
Late summer of 1964, the Tonkin Gulf incident was reported to have occurred, and Lyndon Johnson ordered the bombing of Haiphong in North Vietnam. Everybody around me had two opinions on the matter. First of all, let's kick some gook ass. The other one was, we shouldn't be bombing those people. I'm not particularly interested in them. I had a slightly different thought. I was thinking of a guy I knew who went to the University of Hanoi, an Esperantist, with whom I was corresponding. And the first thing I thought of was his father and his two sisters who lived in Haiphong. Had they gotten hit by our bombs? So when it has a personal meaning to you, you tend to think about things a little differently than when it doesn't.
Esperanto's knack for connecting people of different cultures makes it the enemy of those who would keep them apart. Dictators, for example. Don has a story about that, too.
I had a friend there in London. His name was Nikolai Richkov. He was from Russia originally. He spent 18 years in Siberia because he spoke Esperanto. On one spring night in 1938, the KGB arrested every single speaker of Esperanto that they could find. They shot 3,000 of them. Most of the rest were shipped off to help improve Russia's foreign currency status by mining gold and cutting timber to sell abroad in places where you couldn't hire people to work.
I just couldn't believe that Stalin would bother to deal with a handful of language nuts. So I checked out Don's story. I found that the Soviets considered Esperanto to be bourgeois internationalism and cosmopolitanism. Stalin himself called it the language of spies. Not all the specifics are fully known, but there are many personal accounts of Esperantists suffering at the hands of the Soviets. Nikolai's story was not unique. Stalin was not the only fascist who hated Esperanto.
Die Gegner werfen uns Nationalsozialisten vor und mir.
Hitler also made personal statements about Esperanto and Mein Kampf. He writes, "As long as the Jew is not master of other peoples, he must, for better or worse, speak their languages. Yet, as soon as the others have become his servants, then all should learn a universal language, Esperanto, for instance, so that by these means the Jew can rule more easily." But surely that sort of oppression is far removed from our enlightened West. However, Don's friend Nikolai found Britain little more tolerant of Esperanto than Stalin's Russia.
He eventually defected to the West. He broadcast for the BBC in Russian to Eastern Europe. And one fine day, he had a brilliant idea. He would broadcast in Esperanto 5 minutes a week. But some fool in Eastern Europe sent a congratulatory letter to the foreign minister, Dennis Healy. It said, "Congratulations on your initiative in using Esperanto, the international language, for broadcasting news to our part of the world." And the story is that Healy hit the ceiling. "Esperanto, the international language," he screamed. "English is the international language." And he telephoned the BBC and he said, "You will cease this at once." And that was the end of it.
What did the British foreign minister have against Esperanto? Don has a theory.
As long as English plays an important role in the world, the United States and Great Britain are going to be the chief sources of literature, of information. And this is very important. Now, just suppose that Esperanto suddenly, let's say as many people, 10% of the world's population, spoke Esperanto as now speaks English. Imagine what a catastrophe that would be for certain countries.
Of course, in most cases, what keeps Esperanto down is indifference, not oppression. As long as native English speakers can use their own language whenever and wherever they go, there's little incentive to learn something new. But English hasn't always been the international language. Latin, French, Spanish, they've all had their turn. It seems likely that someday a language like Chinese might challenge English for supremacy. Maybe then, when faced with the daunting task of memorizing countless characters and tones, people will give Esperanto a shot.
And I think at that point Esperanto will at least get a little boost. It is relatively easy to learn compared with, let's say, English or Chinese. You can reach a point at which you can actually use the language much sooner.
Is Esperanto more than some kind of novelty, some kind of quaint diversion? In coming years, international communication is going to change a lot. Given the choice, wouldn't you want a language that's easy to learn? One that will allow you to exchange ideas with people around the world, or just order a Big Mac in Beijing? I think Esperanto is the international language of choice. In fact, I decided to learn a little bit myself. So until next time, Geese Revito.
Bolas, comprensi.
Ben Savage, David Heyman, and Nate Solon are recent Stanford graduates.